Come. It is time to keep your appointment with the Wicker Man.
Hello everyone and welcome to episode 9 of the Wicker Man podcast, where every week myself and a different guest go through the 1973 cult horror classic The Wicker Man, one scene at a time. I am joined on this week's episode by Leandra Lynn. Leandra, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, how are you?
Yeah, I'm doing good, thanks. Well, for anyone listening and those that, in terms of how we've been recording this, this is actually probably one of the episodes recorded closest to May Day. Bit of a nice little tidbit for... in terms of the overall context of the film.
Yeah, and it's great because all of my neighbors are just running around naked, dancing around, you know, as is normal.
As they do. Seen any maypoles yet?
Not yet.
Guessing they saved that for the day itself.
Yeah.
Okay, then. So in this section of the film, following on from the previous one, we get is mainly the conversation between Sergeant Howie and Lord Summerisle going into the religious differences between Howie's Christianity and the paganism of the residents of Summerisle, and then a bit of history about the island, why it's been so useful in growing certain types of fruits, how it's became an agricultural powerhouse in that region of Scotland, and also the reason for why the pagan religion was brought back to the island. And then going into the end of the scene with Howie finally realising that he's got permission to exhume the grave of Rowan Morrison and finding a March Hare inside. So before we dive into discussing this scene in question, Leandro, what's your history of the film and your general thoughts on it?
So I don't have a huge amount of history with the film. I watched it, I think, once growing up, and I was like, wow, this is really weird. And then I rewatched it again as an adult and was definitely taken aback by the fact that I watched this as a young child. It's like, oh, I shouldn't have been, this shouldn't have been something that I should have watched. I really love films of this era because it seems like you're really encapsulating the fact that what is considered acceptable is starting to change for everybody, and you're getting a lot of media in this time that that start pushing the envelope for what would normally be seen on a film that people would be watching in a normal theater at the very least. So I really love just kind of the snapshot of what culture thought was appropriate or perhaps right on the cusp of appropriate for the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's always interesting, especially when I think about it in the context of the remake, how much more daring this original one feels, especially for it being like in the early 70s, you know, it's a few years after stuff like Clockwork Orange. It was that still got the wider censorship battles with the BBFC. You've got stuff like the works of Ken Russell that were being heavily cut down by the BBFC and the American censors, and you know, a few years out from the video nasties for Raw in the UK. It's always interesting how I don't really think you could get this film made in this way any other time than in the early 70s.
Absolutely. And then, like, you even see, just a couple of years later, you see the Rocky Horror Picture Show, and by that point, some of the things that were very much off the table, it seems, are much more comfortable for an audience. And I don't think that you could have had something like the Rocky Horror Picture Show without the Wicker Man coming out just a little bit before that to prime the waters.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I'd say in terms of definitely having that changing sensibility and general acceptance of being a bit more taboo with what's being allowed to be presented on film at this time.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so yeah, then well, let's get into this section of the film. And so first of all, it's probably one of the more dialogue heavy sections of the film. So like it's one of the only significant parts of the film that doesn't have a pretty big musical number in it. Well, it's like, the ending of this section starts with the next bit of music in the film. Well, this is primarily a dialogue based section of the film, and I really think that it's this moment that really helps make The Wicker Man stand on its own in terms of having that thematic weight, particularly the religious conflict that forms the heart, for me, of the film, with Lord Summerisle talking about the pagan beliefs of the island, in particular in his description of the fire leap that was seen in the last scene, and how he's just, best way to describe it, I think, is righteous indignation over it, seeing the whole thing as heresy and an affront to his Christian values. But it's an interesting one where, in this section, Lord Summerisle comes across to me as the more reasonable party. He's more calm, collected. He's gently explaining everything. He's more willing to hear out Howie and provide a bit of an argument with him, and Howie just feels completely closed off and unwilling to even entertain the idea that these could be acceptable values.
It really is amazing just to watch Christopher Lee very calmly explaining the steps that were taken in order to get this entire island to where they are now. And just he adds so much gravitas to the scene. And you really, as an audience member, have to agree with him. You're like, yeah, this is clearly logical. You've gone from point A to point B, and I can understand how your grandfather maybe didn't believe this, but no, your dad grew up with a lot of respect for it, and now, of course, you have a lot of respect and love and fear of nature, and you are now one of the believers of the old gods. And I'm very struck by how logical Lord Summerisle is, like you said, because of course you would think that that pagans kind of represent a free spirit, kind of a wild, chaotic energy, and that's not the case at all.
Yeah, I mean, he does see get the sinister side later on in the film, but even up to this point of the film, there's never really been anything overtly sinister about the beliefs themselves. It's, you can see how, even like in this scene, talk about the fire leap, you can see how it's part of their respect for the power of nature, in this instance, the power of the fire, and how they consider it to be a natural extension of their gods. And it's interesting with how it's contrasted with Christianity, like how we just feeling all indignant and the very idea of reproduction without sexual intercourse. But then Summerisle brings up the point, well, Jesus was a virgin birth and Mary was impregnated by a ghost. It's that kind of thing where it helps make Lord Summerisle seem like the more reasonable party.
And you can even extend that, like before he even brought up the virgin birth, he's explaining why the children are nude. And of course they're nude. They're jumping over fire. It would be dangerous for them to be clothed. And of course that makes perfect sense. And the counter to that argument would be, no, it's why are they over the fire? But of course, we don't get that argument. We just get the indignation about the entire thing.
Yeah, and also it does kind of add to general feel that I've got for our Edward Woodward's performance in The Wicker Man, is that sense of repression he has. And as we've, like, it's made clear later on and earlier in the film that Howie is a virgin himself, and the more overt sexuality and embrace of those ideals is what's part of the affront to him. But for someone like the residents, they just kind of see it as natural. They don't really see, like, nudity as anything to be ashamed of. It's like we've seen earlier in the church, people being naked, having sex out in the open. And Howie just feels really repressed in his own sexuality, and especially, and it helps work with how they were able to entrap him and kind of keep him on the island by playing into his own repression.
I think that this is a really great scene to look at as a turning point, because I think before that point you're kind of on board with Sergeant Howie and going, this is very strange. Everything about this is against what I would normally agree in. And then through this scene, you see the logic behind it. You see the history of it, and there's something very fun about having that internal conflict of like, well, on the one hand, I wouldn't wander around naked in a town because of course I wouldn't, but is it really wrong for other people to do that?
Yeah, I mean, probably wasn't because, well, it's the Scottish Highlands, it's probably absolutely freezing. Well,
oh, absolutely.
I mean, definitely during when they were filming, it was probably around, like, if I remember right, it was around autumn when they were filming, so it was definitely freezing colds for everyone there.
Oh, I hadn't even thought about that. Oh, I definitely not nude around then.
I mean, I'm someone who does, like, open water swimming in, like, near single-digit degree temperatures, well, Celsius. And so I don't really mind the cold, but I could imagine some people being a bit bothered by that.
Absolutely.
I find it interesting with Howie, at, you know, definitely with the themes of the repression and all sort of, and I've mentioned it before, probably mentioned again, is I don't really think we've seen Howie, outside of him when he's in his bedroom, not in uniform. He feels like part of the repression, that at all times he feels like he has to be this rigid sense of entitlement and enforcement, that he won't allow himself even for a moment to be in any way casual, that he has to be on the job and the full representative of the law at all times. And even at the end of the scene when he just says the one thing he cares about is the law. And you feel like that's part of why Howie feels so repressed, that he doesn't really consider anything outside of what his rigid ideals of the law are.
I think that that is probably why he seemed like such a perfect choice for being a sacrifice.
Yeah, definitely.
Because he's such a symbol. He internalized the fact that he is just who he can be. What he does for a living and his actions, and he's nothing past that. If he could, I'm sure that he would sleep fully clothed in uniform so that he could just spring to action at a moment's notice.
Yeah, definitely. And it's what really works about Wood's performance here, especially in this scene, is that more rigid uptightness. And especially when compared with Christopher Lee, like at this time, Lee was best known for the Hammer films, for Dracula, Frankenstein, for the more monstrous characters. But we know that Lee is an incredibly charismatic individual, and this really plays up to just how charismatic a figure he can be. And you can definitely see why Lee was so taken with this character, and why he just spent so much time promoting it, the film, whenever he can, and he considers this to be his personal favourite of the films he made.
And I can see why. This is a film that he really thrives in. It's a character that's almost delicious in its in how luxurious it is in itself. I really am delighted that I was able to get such a Christopher Lee heavy scene to talk about, because he really is just perfect in this.
Yeah, definitely. And it's one of the things where you can't really see this character working with anyone other than Christopher Lee. Like, you think of the remake where Brian Wright was Ellen Burstyn in this role. And no matter what, how good a performer she is, there's no way she could compete with the magnetic presence of Christopher Lee.
Of course, and I feel like the horror film Midsommar,
yeah,
did a lot with this film, and they made a great choice by, instead of having it be a direct redoing of The Wicker Man, they really did some thoughtful editing of the story to make it different. And one of the things that they did was they removed the Lord Summer Isle sort of character from it. And I think that if you don't have Christopher Lee, going without the Lord Summer Isle character is definitely the right choice.
Yeah, definitely. Because, yeah, again, I said, there's no way anyone can really compete with Christopher Lee. It's become such an iconic presence and character of his that, same with overall, so like with Lord of the Rings, is Promise of Saruman. Even when I've been reading the books and whenever I read them, I can only think of Saruman's voice as Christopher Lee's.
Oh, absolutely. He's just iconic and the right choice for this role, and certainly the right choice for Sowerman.
Yeah, definitely. And also, like, with the dialogue as well, because, you know, it's one where even with as charismatic a performer as Christopher Lee, you know, if the writing's not strong enough, then the whole film would kind of fall apart. And it's this scene that's really the dialogue focus, where if this dialogue didn't work, the whole film would have fallen apart, because I think this is the key point for the essential thematic weight of the film. And, you know, Anthony Chaffin's script does a great job at building this. And, you know, it's one where previously he's a fairly prolific writer. You know, previously did Sleuth with Laurence Olivier, Michael Caine, and After Chop's Frenzy. And after this, wrote the Albert Finney and Peter Ustinov Poirot films. And you can kind of see that mystery writer element throughout Chaffin's script for The Wicker Man.
Oh, for sure. There's something that leaves you constantly questioning the reality of the scene through this, and I think that with any other script, the service of this story, I think that you lose that.
Again, compared with the remake, the script of the remake was one of the things that helped kill it and destroyed any chances of it being as strong a work in comparison to the original. And you don't really get seen as strong as this conversation in the remake.
Very much agreed.
But yeah, then actually going into the meat of this conversation in the film. Firstly, it's interesting seeing that we get this bit of history on agriculture and Victorian era, like, developments in science, and kind of helping to explain the agricultural prowess of Sumra. Like, you know, that the residents believe it's the that embrace of the old gods and paganism. What's, you know, kind of what it really is ideal climate for certain strains of fruits and vegetables, and someone being willing to experiment and try it out, and kind of helps demonstrate how religion can be used by your individuals as a means to an end. Like it was mentioned earlier, Lord Sumra's grandfather didn't really believe in it. It's used it as a means to an end, and it was only kind of as the generations passed down and as the fruits of the first Lord Sumra's experiments came to fruit that, and we see how it worked, that we see how the religion is kind of a bit of a feedback loop where, and a bit of post hoc ego propter hoc, where we see Lord Sumra's grandfather is like, if you embrace the old gods, the fruits will grow. You see him, you know, he's used his own specific breeds to do that. And then once the fruits paid off, then it's kind of helps the residents of Sumra Isle embrace the pagan ideals wholeheartedly. And it's interesting how it demonstrates the way religion can be exploited.
But I think that it's very cool that despite it starting as a religious kind of coercion into this agricultural thing, even though Lord Sumra Isle, Christopher Lee's Lord Sumra Isle, is fully aware of the history and is a religious zealot, he's able to hold both the reality of how we got there and the beliefs of the old gods just together without sounding completely unhinged.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I've always found fascinating, especially with Lee's performance, is the debates of how much he actually believes it, whether he's just using it like his grandfather did as a means to an end, or whether he does genuinely believe it. And, you know, as the film goes on, and we know that he really knows the history, that it wasn't really the old gods, but he's grown to believe it and embrace the traditions and culture of the old gods. And it's interesting, you know, as the film goes on, especially when we actually get to the reveal of how he's sacrificed and the Wicker Man itself, the question of how will Sumra Isle continue to espouse those beliefs if things go wrong again.
And I genuinely believe that that next harvest, if things don't go well, then Lord Sumra Isle is going to be the next sacrifice, and he's hoping that it doesn't come to that. But I believe strongly that that he would just play his part.
And then, yeah, then we'd also know that no matter what, it wouldn't really do anything. It's whole thing feels like, especially with the description of the history of Sunbrow's agriculture, that they've used up all the nutrient value of the soil, that what needs to happen is a rest period to allow the soil to regain its nutrients. And at that point, then the fruits will grow again. But if that happens after Howie's sacrifice, then the residents somehow would see, oh, it's a validation of their beliefs. Again, the post-hoc ergo propter hoc aspect of it.
It really is wonderful to kind of think about what the aftermath of this film would be.
And it's one of the things that makes me thankful that this was a one-and-done film. Like, there were plans for sequels. There was the pseudo-sequel of The Wicker Tree in the 2000s. But that sense of mystery and the what happened next, it's, and whether or not how we sacrificed did anything, whether the beliefs were real or whether it just didn't do anything, or whether it's all just agricultural practices that needs to be properly respected, is the whole thing of why it works that this is just a standalone film.
Very much agreed. If they were to completely reboot this like next year, it would be this film, a sequel, a prequel, Son of Wicker Man. It would just be constant media on it. And I think that it would do a great disservice.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And it's one of our works that, the modern trend of folk horror is stuff that's kind of inspired by The Wicker Man, but never no actual attempt to do a new version of it as a new version of The Wicker Man. Since the Nicolas Cage remake.
I know that we keep bringing up the remake, and it just wasn't good.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that really helps you appreciate just how good this original was. You see just how badly that version failed.
Absolutely.
Yeah, then also what helps with the conversation about the agricultural practices and the unique climate of Summer Isle is the way that the scene is filmed, like having it go through Lord Summerisle's manor and then out into the gardens, and we see the palm trees, and that kind of helps establish the unique environment of Summerisle. So, and as I mentioned in episode 2 of this podcast, those kind of palm trees are a unique feature in that area of Scotland. And as I mentioned in the early episode, the village of Plockton, where Howie's arrival at on Summer Isle was filmed, you can, even to this day, you can still see the palm trees along the shoreline. And it's those kinds of details of where they chose to film it that helps give this film a unique kind of feel to it. This kind of otherworldly, slightly unnatural feel, even though you know it's all natural features of the Scottish environment.
It really is delightful and something that could only have been done with this film.
Yeah, and I mean, even filming in not ideal conditions for the weather, they still know how to properly frame everything so that it all works, and you do get those bits of visual storytelling as well as the more exposition heavy dialogue here.
I also really enjoy that as we're hearing about the history of how the old gods were brought to the Isle, you're in the house, but as we're following Lord Summer Isle's story through this, and how and we discover that he is very much in one of the true believers, that's all outdoors. So you're also physically almost rejecting the stuffiness of Victorian belief and embracing nature.
Yeah, and you can definitely kind of see that as the trajectory of the Lord Summerisle's family. You're going from the, as I said, the Victorian zeal and the more exploitative aspects of Lord Summerisle's grandfather, but not really believing it, the kind of more uptight, not real time, but the more formalised setting of it and using it as a means to an end. But then as the film goes on, we go more into the gardens and seeing that as, again, the visual storytelling of the generations of Summerisle's family going more and more embracing the ideals and culture of this religion.
Truly, the storytelling in this scene is just really well thought out from every angle.
Yeah, it's one thing that, again, is why it makes this such an important scene of the film, and how every aspect of this all aligns together to make this work so well. And again, if any one aspect of the writing, the filmmaking, the acting didn't work in this scene, then the whole film probably would have fallen apart.
Absolutely. All of this was so experimental and so, like, different than what one would expect, that you are absolutely correct, that if anything had been slightly different or slightly off, it wouldn't have worked.
And then also works in terms of how the dialogue is presented, more towards the end of this section, when Howie once again reiterates that the reason he'd come to Lawson Rouse Manor was to get permission to exhume Rowan Morrison's grave. And whole thing of Lawson Rouse saying, oh, he was under the impression that he'd already given permission. And then if you go back and rewatch the scene earlier as the scene starts, you can see, yeah, Lawson Rouse gave permission right at the start of the scene. And the whole thing afterwards was just that building on the talk about those specific practices that how we can see outside the window, and then the history of the island. But yeah, he did give permission. That's those kinds of details that really help with rewatches of this film.
Absolutely. And the fact that we see Howie just getting completely riled up over everything and missing the fact that he already got the approval is, I think, one of the things that makes him such a good character to watch fall apart.
And yeah, it also kind of works in establishing Howie's lack of ability to listen or gain understanding of Samurai. If, you know, he missed that, the whole reason he came there was he'd already got that approval. It's clear that he wouldn't really care or pay attention to anything. And it also works how he gets Edward Woodward shouting quite a bit in the scene, like, and yeah, as compared to the more soft-spoken nature of Christopher Lee.
And I know that I said it before, but that's very much a reversal. You think of kind of your stereotypical pagan to be the more chaotic, the one more likely to be shouting, and your typical, I'd say, Christian police officer to be more logical and calculating. But just the reversal on this is really what makes everything feel so off-kilter.
And you know, especially like when we get the bit when Howie, it's almost with disgust that he shouts at Lord Samurai that his father brought him up to be a pagan, and then Samurai responds sort of a heathen but no doubt an educated one. In stuff like that, it helps really establish that Samurai is more inclined to respect and understand Samurai rather than Howie, at least to me.
Oh, I very much agree with you.
Yeah, you kind of expect that more anger shouts off to be in other films, you expect it to be through the pagans is kind of a way to establish, you know, these are clearly the villains and you should know not to trust them or to respect them if they're so against accepting the predominant ideology of a country. But here, in having that reversal of Howie being the more indignant party in this scene, kind of helps make this more thought-provoking and more morally complex film. And it's, again, the reason that makes this such a compelling watch.
I think even to a modern audience that maybe isn't so... I think that most people who are watching this now aren't necessarily a conservative Christian sort of audience, and because of that you already go into it with a little bit more sympathy for the islanders and Lord Summer Isle. And this is just another scene, really, if you are already not necessarily a fully Christian idealist person, that you're going, yeah, this is what it looks like when somebody so aggressively believes that their one God is the right one and everything else is wrong and stupid and bad and scary.
Yeah, also kind of thinking about other like folk horror in the vein of The Wicker Man, like you mentioned, Midsommar earlier, at the point where Florence Pugh's character comes to accept and embrace the beliefs of the community in Midsommar, is after a prolonged period of kind of gaslighting, emotional distress, and kind of being broken down. And it's kind of really only at that point that she's willing to accept the beliefs of that community. Whereas here, it's all it takes is just kind of this kind of more casual conversation. And again, it's what makes this such a compelling film. Like, sort of like Midsommar, it's that tinge throughout the film of the antagonistic or more manipulative. Whereas here, it kind of feels more as a natural extension, and it's only really at the end of the film that the more sinister nature comes out. But at that point, we've got this full understanding of the history and culture of the island, especially through this scene, that even if you don't... hopefully you don't agree that burning policemen alive in a giant wicker man is helpful to grow harvests. But you kind of understand why the residents of Summer Isle would think that's the right thing to do, or at least their last resort.
I'll say this. If Christopher Lee told me very calmly why it is that he would need to burn a police officer in a wicker man, I would understand. I'd be like, oh, okay. You've given me a lot to think about, but go ahead and go about your business. And I think that that speaks not only to the writing, but of course to Christopher Lee being just such a great choice for this role, and just how permissive I feel, of course.
And yes, also then we've got the end of this scene, with Howie back in the graveyard, and he's with the caretaker at the churchyard talking about when they've exhumed the grave and they look into it, and we get that really well done creepy laugh from the caretaker, leading into the reveal of the hair in Rowan's coffin. And these little kinds of things that, even with the more genial atmosphere of Summer Isle scene, there is still this undercurrent of tension and mystery throughout the film. Then the question, why is there a hair in the grave?
And the way that the gravedigger is laughing, it definitely seems like he is the voice for the entire village at that point, because of course everybody knew that that the hair was in the grave. The only person who didn't was Howie, and that's why Lord Summer Isle said, of course you can exhume the grave, there's nothing there that would be amiss. And I think that this really is a great moment of just making you second guess everything that you've watched to this point.
And also works well with how it was filmed, like having that be shot like from the coffin and pointing upwards towards Howie and the caretaker. And it was that build of tension as we see them exhuming the grave, we see the laugh of the gravedigger and the anger on Howie as it builds up to the reveal of the hair. And it's just a well-done bit of filmmaking to build up that tension.
And certainly I don't remember how I reacted to this as a child, but when I rewatched it as an adult, I remember feeling that I had been somewhat anxious and on edge watching it, and then at that point, not quite laughing with the gravedigger, but having that sort of, having the tension release at that moment was very physically satisfying.
And it's that kind of bit of release as well, that dark comedy that you probably think of with the film.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and then also kind of it also works as well in terms of how the film has established Rowan throughout the film, like even with the going right back to the start of the film with the bit when Howie's goes to the post office and talks with Rowan's sister, and we get that first bit establishing the connection between Rowan and the March Hare. And so when you think about it, Of course, it's going to be a hare in there, as it's all part of the con and the joke and the way they've built up the mystery and tension for Howard specifically. So, yeah, of course, they're building everything all on top of each other to make it as suspicious as possible for Howie. So it'd be why he'd be to make him so willing to stay on the island. They want that these reactions to, they want him to more question anything so that he'd be more inclined to stay.
And I think that that's an earmark of a very good mystery, that you should be able to, when you think back, see all of the clues that should have indicated that this was going to be what happened. And it shouldn't, upon further reflection, actually be that much of a surprise. But of course it is, because the clues aren't so obvious to you at first.
Yeah, and this obviously what makes it a good film to rewatch, and why like I've wanted to do this podcast in the first place, because there's so much meat you can talk about with The Wicker Man, going through each bit and thinking how it all plays back on each other and how everything all builds up to get to the point where if you watch it a second time after already knowing how it ends, you can see that every aspect of the behaviour of the rest of Summer Isle is manipulation. They're all carefully designed to manipulate Howie into getting to that precise location at that precise time. And it's such a great bit of writing for the whole script that it works so well on that rewatch.
It's what makes this a cult classic, absolutely.
And again, it's something that the remake, again, don't want to keep mentioning the remake, but it's something that the remake doesn't do right. It's everything in its original version of The Wicker Man, you can feel there's a purpose to it all, and how they're specifically designed to play to Howie's perceptions and fears, whereas in the remake, it all feels weird for the sake of being weird. There doesn't seem to be any point behind it in terms of that being played specifically to manipulate Howie. Or, well, Nicolas Cage is a character in the remake.
I feel like maybe the reason that it's so easy to compare and contrast the remake in this part of the conversation for this scene is the fact that this scene was so expertly done for the original, and such a letdown in the remake. And this is a kind of a microcosm of the entire piece as far as that goes.
Yeah, I mean, definitely in the later episode with Howie's search of the island, that's another key point where you can definitely understand how things went so wrong with the remake and why this original works so well. But yeah, again, you've got this scene, and it's such a strong piece of writing, directing, and acting. It all builds up with each other, and how the film has been built up throughout to help build up the mystery and Howie's perceptions of Howie and the audience's perceptions of the island. And it's what helps make this such a compelling scene and what helps make the film work so well.
Absolutely agreed. I know I've said it before, but I'm just delighted that I was able to talk about this specific scene.
Yeah, so yeah, before we finish up, is there any other thoughts you have on this scene in particular, or any other sections of The Wicker Man that you'd want to talk about just in general?
Oh, no, I'm very excited to hear what other people have thought about The Wicker Man. This is such an interesting film, and I love just all of the different things that you can get out of this.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, it's definitely one that has really stood the test of time, especially as the different versions of The Wicker Man have come out. And if we're right, we're getting a 4K restoration of The Wicker Man by Studio Canal this year to tie into the 50th anniversary. And just see more people growing to see and appreciate this original film for the cult classic that it is.
And it deserves to be watched. Very much so. Sometimes you get a cult classic that's watched because it's such a strange piece, but there's so much artistic value in this film that it really does deserve the following.
Yeah, and again, final comparison with the remake in this episode. The remake is the cult classic because of its unintentional comedy value and, you know, all the memes with Nicolas Cage's performance. Whereas here, it's a cult classic because of the circumstances of its release and how it came about and being such a unique, odd piece of filmmaking at the time that has helped by it being a genuinely good folk horror film.
100% agreed.
Okay. Yeah, and with that, we've come to the end of episode 9 of the podcast. Leandra, I'd like to thank you for joining me on this episode.
Of course, I was very happy to chat with you.
Yeah, and before we leave, do you have anything you want to plug?
Yes, I'd love for people to check out my podcast. It's Rocky Horror Minute, and you can get all the information at rockyhorrorminute.com.
Yeah, and then for me, you can find my main stuff outside of this podcast over at my site, coopsviews.wordpress.com. You can find my social media at Twitter, at Tony Coos, and on Instagram, at Kogan Tony. And Andrew, I'd like to thank you again for taking part on this episode.
Of course. And I think I'm just going to go outside and go frolic naked because I just saw a maypole pop up.
Ah, good stuff. Good stuff. Yeah, then, it's the May Day weekend, so, yeah, take advantage of it.
Yeah, it'll be great.
Yeah, and to everyone listening to this podcast, thank you for listening, and I'll speak to you again next time.